as one of the speakers. I don't really know our speaker, except from the interactions I've had when I met him here. He seems like a very bubbly man. I was glad that we chose him out of the selections as one of the speakers. He's got a great message, and here is Michael.
Thanks, y'all. My name is Michael, and I'm an alcoholic. And since I'm from Texas, I guess I have to do this the Texas way and tell you that my sobriety date is 11/26/88, for which I'm really grateful. I'd like to start by thanking the committee for asking me to be here. I've always find it an honor to do some service work for Alcoholics Anonymous. I usually don't speak in front of rooms that are quite this big, and I've never really had a light on me like that, but we'll do the best we can. I met some wonderful people here, and I want to thank them all for their help. Jan for picking me up at the airport, and Charlie, and Louie, and of course your co-chairs, Mary and Michael. They've been very helpful. I had to change outfits 3 times to match this backdrop. Who knew? I mean, the silver balls are especially entertaining. It reminds me of a movie I saw that Chi-Chi LaRue did. I have to tell you that I did not bring any props with me. I'm so sorry, Chris. I have no props. I have no pearls. I do have this little dog chain that I might use later. But I just didn't know I was supposed to bring props. I actually do have, though, some friends from Dallas that may help me a little bit. They could be used as props, I'm sure. And plus, I had a little wonderful surprise that my friend Helen and Lois came in, and you know, between the two of them, they have 75 years of sobriety. Is that not amazing? You know, the program tells us we're supposed to tell in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. For most of us, that is the easy way to do it. It's a little sleazy for us Texans to tell that story. If you think it's bad tonight, wait till you hear Starkey tomorrow night. Before I tell my story, though, I always like to start with a couple of disclaimers. The first one I like to talk about is, if there's anything I say that you and your sponsor can't reconcile with the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, I suggest you throw it away, because it's my opinion, and opinions can get people very drunk in this program. The tradition states Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on issues, but alcoholics have a lot of opinions on issues, in particular, and they can get you very drunk, so I try to stick to my experience. The second thing I need to tell you is, my drug of choice is whatever you had the most of. It didn't matter if it was cocaine, or if it was heroin, or if it was tequila and Diet Dr. Pepper. You know, it's not my first choice. What I have learned, though, is Alcoholics Anonymous is my recovery of choice. I could go to a 12-step program for every problem I have, and I would not have time to work. Sorry, that's just the way it happened. The other thing I need to tell you, and it's probably the most important thing, at least I have to say for myself tonight, and that's that Alcoholics Anonymous has forever changed my life. It's altered me, and it's given me a life that I probably don't deserve and never even knew I wanted, and I thank you for that. I was born, actually, in a small town in mid-eastern Ohio. I'm not Texan by birth. I got there as soon as I could. Texans love to hear that. And you know, it's been wonderful through the years to get to look at my family of origin again. I've gotten to go back and spend some time with them. And at the time, I thought it was a fairly idyllic childhood. And then I kind of thought maybe there were some problems with it. And then after coming to Alcoholics, Italian, because my parents had just gotten too old. We drank for every occasion there was. We drank for birthdays, weddings, anniversaries, plus all those wonderful feasts of the church, you know, confirmation, first communion. whenever there were people around, we would drink at our house. It took me until sobriety to realize, though, that most families don't buy beer 20 cases at a time, and Jim Beam by the case, but that's the way we did it at home. Because that, I started drinking at a very early age. I didn't drink alcoholically at an early age, I just drank at an early age, and it was just always available. I know my parents today did the best they could with what they knew. To believe any different than that, I would have to think that they would sit up after we went to bed at night, over a drink, and talk to each other like this. How do you think we can fuck the kids up tomorrow? I know they did not do that. Your parents probably didn't either. You know, my parents are at the age I am now, and they were trying to raise four kids and get us to school and get our homework done and make their mortgage payment and do the things that we all do. And although they maybe didn't do it perfectly, I know they did it the best they could. And when I take out that premeditation that they tried to hurt me, everything else healed by itself. I came out at a very early age. When I went to school, I was a very effeminate little boy. I've tried to tone that down a bit. When I went to school, I was just one of those little kids who got, my books knocked out of my hands all the time and got locked into my locker and stuff like that. They called me fag. I didn't even know what it was. I thought it was a cigarette. So what happened is my parents actually found a box of letters that I had written to a boyfriend. What happened to that family and why it's important in my recovery is because that family went directly into chronic alcoholism. Everybody started drinking a lot. My sisters, my brother. My little sister was only 8. She didn't drink too much. But everybody else did. Because they just did not know what else to do. They had no other solution, no other ways of dealing with that. That was a few years ago. There weren't books, there weren't internets to check on. They had no idea what to do. I was also a very patriotic little boy. And it took me years of sobriety to realize this, that if I would have told my father in 1975 that I decided I wanted to join the Vietnam War, he would have been frightened because he knew nothing but bad things about that path. And he knew nothing about bad things in the path of being a homosexual. And when I realized that he was frightened and therefore angry, that all went away too. They just did the best they could. I graduated from high school, and I was actually a very good student. I was a human doing. I wasn't a human being, but I did a lot of stuff. I was busy all the time just because I was afraid. I'm not sure what I was afraid of, but I was going places all the time, doing things, trying to get out of the house. And, of course, when I'd go to school, I'd have to bring some of my medicine with me. I mean, I didn't know that you weren't supposed to bring bourbon to school, and so I just did. I put in a little Miracle Whip jar, and I would take it to school instead of get my locker. And then sometimes during the day, if I needed a little bit of liquid courage, I would just pour some with some 7-Up and have a little cocktail. I grew up at a time when there weren't other drugs around, at least not in that little town at that time. I went to Brazil as soon as I graduated from high school for 3 months. I don't remember anything. We drank a lot there. They had this wonderful stuff called pinga, and then we just kept drinking it and drinking it. It's like 140 proof, and it's like a quarter. I was amazed. I came back, and I went off to college. And at college, I started having some problems with alcohol. Actually, the first day when you go for orientation, I went to orientation, and I started smoking Marlboros that night. I don't know what brought that on, but I decided to start smoking Marlboros, and I drank Jim Beam. And I drank a whole bottle of Jim Beam. And I remember coming to, and there was a 350-pound naked woman on top of me. It was quite terrifying. And you know, from that day forward, I never smoked another Marlboro. It was in college that I was introduced to drugs other than alcohol. That happened, actually. I had a college roommate. He introduced me to drugs other than alcohol, and I introduced him to sex with men other than his brothers. That is a true story that he hates for me to tell. And what we used to do is we used to just drink and do anything we could
only
find.
About a half hour away,
you know,
and get some more alcohol,
or we would try some marijuana or anything we could find. And we started doing it kind of on a routine basis. First it was just on Wednesdays and the weekend, and then it was on a little bit more often than that. I had a bar in my room because I didn't know you weren't supposed to. Alcohol was still my friend. I had no problems and complications from it at that point. I did have some times, though, that things just didn't work out perfectly. I went home one time for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, you know, in an Italian Catholic family is like an honored tradition. And, you know, I mean, my sisters didn't even bring their husbands home until they were husbands. Well, I had gone out the night before to Youngstown, and I picked up this guy. And we went somewhere, and we came home the next day. And my mom said, you brought someone. And I said, yeah, this is, what's your name again, honey? Things like that started happening. I would do those blackout things where you'd wake up and you had no idea where you were. Who was with you, where your clothes were, what city you were in. I did that on a routine basis, and I thought it was just fun. I just thought if you drank, you had to at least have some blackouts because that's the only thing I knew of. All the other people I hung around with did the exact same thing. I think as alcoholics, we like to do that. We like to hang around people that are just as bad as we are and a couple that were just a little worse. I decided after I graduated from college that I was going to go off to graduate school, and I had made my first geographic at that point. I knew if I stayed in Cleveland, I would not be able to graduate from graduate school. So I decided to make a geographic, and I went to Columbus, Ohio, where I did lots of drinking. It was so funny. The first year I was there, I was kind of scared, so I kind of behaved myself and went to class a lot and did all those things. And, you know, it's funny, in retrospect, when I have those periods where I'm doing really well, I think, well, I'm probably not an alcoholic. And what I realized is I probably hadn't crossed that line yet. I probably could still choose not to drink. I started in my second year of graduate school getting kind of lonely. I hadn't met anybody yet. And there was only probably one way that I knew how to meet people. And I went out to the bars and started meeting people. And I started running with this crowd that I probably shouldn't have been in from the beginning. The guy I went home with the first time, actually I went home with him three times, and he could never remember my name. And his name was Michael. And I should have known then that something was desperately wrong. But I continued in that vein, and I met a bunch of people, and we just, again, partied the way we were supposed to. I didn't know you were supposed to do it any other way. Had a couple bad experiences then, too. I'd been dating this guy named Pat. I had this problem when I went out with him that sometimes I would forget, like I would go out with him, but I would forget who I went out with, and so I'd start kissing on somebody else, and he was kind of closed-minded about that stuff back then. And we're on the way home. I've been doing bunches of, I think, ketamine that night. It was something different to try for a while. This was a long time ago. This was before Special K was just a breakfast cereal. That's interesting, by the way. Now, all those drugs have names. They're all letters. It's like alphabet soup. Anyhow, I'm doing all this stuff, and he says something to me, and gets in my face, and I lean forward and nearly take his lip off with my teeth. Nearly bite his face off. The worst problem was he had to go to the hospital I worked at and explain to them that I don't know what happened. Something happened. I can't remember what. So I had people that protected me. And they had to protect me because I was the one who kept bringing all the alcohol and drugs home. And I think we were all probably, at least at that point, having problems with figuring out what we wanted to do with our alcoholism. Anyhow, I decided that wasn't working. I had to make another geographic, so I decided at that point I was going to go down to Texas. I figured Texas was big enough, and I could lose myself there. We gathered everybody together. We had a little caravan that went down. We looked kind of like the Beverly Hillbillies without the rocking chair. There were 10 of us, 6 cars, a station wagon, mattresses strapped on the roof. It was actually kind of cute. I remember as soon as we got into Texas, we passed through Texarkana, and I thought, we're in Texas now, let's go get us a couple beers. So we pulled up to the first gas station and said, we're looking for some beer, and they said, well, you have a long way to drive, son, because the next wet county is Dallas County. And I had never heard anything like that in my life. It was like, backwood place. Well, we made up for it when we got to Texas. We started drinking and drugging just like we always did. You know, it's interesting because I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous and drugs are part of my story, but I have to remember that when we had nothing else, a couple bottles of Jim Beam was just fine. We drank every day and did drugs occasionally. And so because of that, I call myself an alcoholic. Plus, I have a thing. I mean, I've never known of any alcoholic who can shoot heroin successfully, and vice versa, any heroin addict who can drink alcohol successfully. So that's why I identify myself as an alcoholic. When I came down to Texas, I got two little pieces of paper that were very helpful for me in what I wanted to do. The first one was a license to practice medicine and surgery in the state of Texas. And the second thing was a DEA license. And we used to use that to go shopping through a little book called the PDR. You know, like, these are pretty, and these are pretty, and we like these, and throw those away, and that kind of stuff. The way I would do that, I was write you a prescription for some kind of medication. You would give me half of them. And then we'd just move on our way. We used to do lots of amphetamines and pain medications. But we used to just do the pills, because I was really proud of the fact that we just did a little bit of partying. We didn't do anything hardcore. Very proud that that had happened that way. It was years later, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ran into this woman who used to work at one of the hospitals I worked at. And I thought, of course, you know, as I do as an alcoholic, that we're invisible, that people don't see what's going on. And she said, I remember you when you worked at St. Paul. You and your boyfriend used to have those huge fights in the lobby. And I wanted to crawl under the couch, because she was exactly right. I knew exactly which fight she was talking about. You know, I have to talk a little bit about what happened in 1987, which is right before I got sober, because the years in between that are just the same. You know, I think all alcoholics have the same story. We all drink and drug as much as we can, and then we wait another 5 or 10 or 15 years until we've proven to ourselves and everybody else that we can't do it anymore, and then we come into AA. And those years are just in the middle. I mean, there were no relationships that lasted. There were no family or friends anymore. I had abandoned everybody because I didn't want them to know what I did. You know, the two great fears of an alcoholic addict are, A, they'll find out, and B, they'll take it away. And I didn't want those things to happen. 1987, by this time, I'd been kind of partying a lot more than I normally did. And I say this especially for the non-alcoholics in the room, because if you were to look at the outside of my life, it was perfect. It was perfect. You know, the cars, the house, the lover, everything looked perfect. But inside, I wanted to die. Every day. My boyfriend at the time, his best friend was a cocaine dealer. That made it just much more convenient. He just brought everything over to the house. I was starting to have more blackouts, and I was also starting to have some brownouts during the days when I would forget kind of what had happened for the last 3 or 4 hours. He escaped one day. We had a huge fight. It was one of those fights that happens, I think, only to alcoholics, where you wake up in the middle of the night or the morning and you realize that they're not there. And so you think, I wonder who in the hell he's sleeping with tonight. And so you go into the next room and you see the door locked and you think, great, he's even in my house. And you bang on the door and they come to the door with a knife. And you say, what's going on in there? And they look back and they say, you don't remember anything, do you? You don't remember what you said, what you did, what you threatened. And you're stuck, because you don't. When I want to think back about having a drink today, I have to think back to those times, because those are the times I don't ever want to have to go through again. Anyhow, after one of those times, Robert escaped. Off he went. Bye-bye. And I knew where he was because he had my credit card, so I could find him. But when he escaped, I had this little box at my house. Now, most of you probably don't have a box like this at home, but I had one at the time. It was 1987. You know, there wasn't anything you could do for AIDS, and I knew as soon as I was diagnosed, I had my little box, my little suicide box. It had an IV in it. It had some sodium pentothal in it. It had a muscle relaxer in it, and it had bunches of narcotics in it. I wish I could tell you there was something special that happened that day, but there really wasn't. I tied up, I shot up like I've been doing it every day of my life. I'm so grateful that happened because it got me here quicker. When you add IV drugs to everything else I was on, you go somewhere fast. It might be prison, it might be a morgue, and I was lucky that I got here. I did that for about 6 months. Work got very interesting. They had no idea what to do with me because they really didn't have any idea what was wrong. You know, the dose response curve of a narcotic is if you do enough of it, you eventually vomit. That's why people get sick when they take codeine and stuff. I made up for that by just shooting up in the bathroom. That way I could just vomit and go on my way. I had a couple bad things happen right at the end of that year. I was putting this little girl to sleep for tubes in her ear. She was 8 months old. And something happened. I don't know what happened. I still don't know what happened. I just remember I backed up from the table. She was very blue. And I said, I can't do this. And luckily, one of my nurses rushed in and gave her some stuff and saved the day. And just chalked it up to a little mistake at work. But it was starting to unravel very quickly. 3 days later, it was Thanksgiving, and I was on call for Thanksgiving, and Stephanie calls me and says, there's a labor patient up here, and we're going to do a C-section as soon as you can get here. So I get in my car, and I go to the hospital, and I call her. I say, you can bring the patient back, and she said, actually, there really isn't a patient here, but there are a lot of people here. See, because I'd known what had happened, because I'd had things like that happen before. About 2 weeks before that, I'd had another incident where I was shooting up in the bathroom. I mean, that's where you do it. It's right there. It's, you know, the little sink, mirror, toilet. I hadn't looked in that mirror in a long time, and I was playing that little game you play. I can quit whenever I want to. I can quit whenever I want to. Little kid in the dark. And I looked into my eyes, and my eyes said, no, you can't. I own you. I will be with you forever. I will be the death of you. So I knew what kind of things could happen. I have to remember today that most anesthesiologists that have this disease end up dead in a bathroom somewhere. So anyhow, I go in to do the C-section, and I walked into an intervention in my own hospital. Best thing that could have happened to me. My friend Dr. Tom was there, and he said, you know, we noticed you're really, really thin. Because I weighed about 130 pounds, I guess. I didn't get any taller in sobriety, so I was pretty emaciated. He said, we noticed you vomit all the time, and that you're really, really thin. And we think there may be a problem. And let me tell you about my drug addiction and my alcoholism. And I listened politely, and I finally said, I vomit all the time because I'm HIV positive. And he said, that may be true. However, could we have a urine sample from you, please? Well, my HIV test came back negative, but my urine sample sure didn't. There were drugs in there I don't even remember taking. I'm so grateful at that point he gave me one choice. Just one choice. Would you like to leave tonight or would you like to leave tomorrow? They cleaned out my locker and they shipped me off to a treatment center in Atlanta. And just like the guy at ER, didn't one of the characters in ER go to Atlanta? That's what they send us, doctors. They send us there so they can help get rid of that ego, you know, that MD is not a master of divinity. You know, it's so wonderful. I really did have a great time in Atlanta. I learned a lot of stuff about Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing I heard in Atlanta was laughter. And I hadn't heard laughter in such a long time. Unless it was that forced laughter that you used to hear at the bar. And I wondered what these people had that they were laughing all the time. Luckily, I stayed there long enough to find out. It was a 3-month program. I got out in 5.5 months. If they would have heard my fifth step, I'd probably still be there. They taught me a lot of things about alcoholism. They taught me about the disease concept of alcohol, that I'm not a bad person, I'm not a stupid person. I have a disease. It's a chronic disease. It's a relapsing disease. It's a deadly disease. But there is a cure. You just have to not drink one day at a time. And I know sometimes that that seems like the hardest thing to do. But I can assure you, if we got a bunch of 15-year-old leukemics in here and told them they could live as long as they just didn't drink alcohol every day, they'd all be standing in line. It's amazing what the denial system does. You know, they've been doing some research on alcoholism, and someday they may find a pill that we can take that will get rid of alcoholism. Just a pill we can take. Of course, I'm not sure how we would live without the steps. And my problem is I'm not sure what I'd do with my clothes and my house. I mean, it was all wrapped around alcoholism. I'm not sure how I'd have to be able to live without the steps, because that's what I learned about in that treatment center. I learned about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learned that they were the things that were going to actually help me find a different way to do this. I got to go to some gay meetings there, and to this day I still go to some gay meetings. My deal with gay meetings is I know a lot how to be gay. I'm not really sure how to be sober. So I kind of go to meetings of all different kinds. Plus, when I first started going to gay meetings, I realized that I had this kind of resentment against straight people. And considering they're 90% of the planet, it was kind of a big resentment. So I thought I'd better get rid of it, or it's going to get drunk. And today, I go to gay meetings and straight meetings. I remember the first time I spoke at a straight meeting, I was kind of worried about it because I have a hard time with he's and she's and stuff, and I just don't ever mess with that. And so they're reading how it works, and I lean over to my sponsor and I say, "Should I tell them that I'm gay?" And he didn't even move his eyes from the speaker. He said, "They're going to watch you walk up to the podium." They're drunks, not fools. The other thing they told me before I left that treatment center is that AA is not group therapy. They don't want to hear about all your shit. They just don't. If you need AA and group therapy, find a group therapy session. I'm so glad they told me that, because when I came back, I didn't have these things that I wanted to talk about at the meeting that I probably should talk to with my sponsor. I'm so grateful they did that, because it helped my transition into Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I left, my little woman who was in charge of my therapy said, "I need to tell you one thing before you leave. It's really important." She said, "You're a young man, and you're somewhat attractive, and you're fairly affluent. And you're a doctor, and you're gay. Your chances of staying sober for 5 years are less than 5%. The only thing that could make it worse is you could also be a person of color. Please, when you leave here, find yourself a good sponsor and go to a good Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." Actually, she said, "I think what would really help you is if you could find a mean lesbian sponsor." Well, at that time, Starkey was still in prison. So I found Jack. Jack was actually much easier. It's so funny how I found my sponsor. I lived across the street from these two girls, and when my sponsor crashed and burned, he was supposed to have lunch with one of these girls. And he obviously never made it to lunch because he crashed and burned. And years later, they became friends, and they were still friends. And I had done all kinds of wild things at that house. I mean, I thought I had intruders one time, and the police were over, and we used to do, you know, racing up and down the street and drag on a motorcycle and just all kinds of things that you shouldn't do in a regular, normal Oak Cliff neighborhood. So I was leaving there, and I told them I'm going to this big AA roundup in Dallas. And Jan got on the phone, dialed Jack. She said, there's a guy leaving now. He's my neighbor. He's in a blue shirt, and he needs help badly. Please find him. And so Jack walked up, and we started working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He taught me a lot of stuff about the steps. I'm still learning stuff about the steps. He taught me about service work early on in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because people who are active in AA usually don't leave. And if that's just making coffee, and if that's doing ashtrays, and if that's sponsoring people, and if that's greeting people, at least you're doing something. I don't know about you, but I hadn't been to an organization that asked me to come back in a long time. And so that's what I did. I just stood there and did the things I was told to do as best I could. Now, there are people who are in that, who are in this room, who were there at that time, who, they made bets on me staying sober, and I guess I was going to lose. I don't know. They'd never thought I'd stay sober for 10 years, let alone any longer, and that just proves to me that we can never tell. I can never tell when people walk in. I can't even tell what the people I sponsor, if they're going to stay sober or not. I just know that if they do certain things and don't do other things, they probably will. When I started going through the steps with Jack, I started by telling him that, you know, I'd gone to this big expensive treatment center and that I actually had done a fourth and fifth step because I had to get out. And that I know I'd only been there for 5.5 months, but that 5.5 months really translated into probably about a year of sobriety. Yeah, he laughed too. I explained to him that I had a lot of degrees after my name, and he said, so does a rectal thermometer. Why I still use him, I have no idea. You know, but I really did get to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to that treatment center on step one. I was done with step one when I got there. I can help anybody I sponsor through any of the steps of AA except for one. Because if you have someplace else to go, if you have one more idea before Alcoholics Anonymous, take it. Go. I had to have no more ideas. I had to have no other way of living except through this program. There was nobody I could call. There's nobody who wanted to take me in. There's nobody who wanted to help me except in the rooms of AA. And I find so many times when people say, maybe I could go try it this way. Go ahead. Maybe it is better in California. I don't know. But usually what happens is wherever I go, there I am. I just bring my problems with me. I got to learn about a higher power. I had a hard time with that because, you know, growing up gay and Catholic, it's not the best way to do that. It's taken me years of sobriety to go back and realize that I do kind of like parts of the Catholic Church. They have fabulous drag. I just don't care for their dogma. And so I go back when I have to, spend some time with my parents and that kind of thing. But I've got to find a God of my own understanding. When I first started working with Jack, he just said, there is a God, it is not you. And we went from there. I have a friend named Dr. Tom, the guy who did my intervention. He always describes it as God and you are on a tandem bicycle. And God's in the front and you're in the back. And that's the way it has to be for me. Because see, when I'm in the back, all I have to do is pedal. I don't have to know where I'm going. I don't have to know how fast I'm going. I don't even have to have any balance. And the best thing is, if I pick my feet up and decide not to pedal, I'm in the back, it doesn't matter. So God and I go on this little journey every day. And we get to see a bunch of things. I got to do a fourth and fifth step again with Jack, and I did that simply because, I don't know, when I had call with problems now, if I had not done my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, I would have to start by saying, hi, my name's Michael, and I'm an alcoholic, and I have this going on, and that going on. My sponsor knows all that. When I start with a problem, he'll say, this is the exact same problem you had 10 years ago, or this is the exact same problem that was in your fourth step, and it's just easier. I spend a lot of time today on 6 and 7. Humility does not come easy to most alcoholics, and especially to this one. I truly believe, though, without some degree of humility, none of us can stay. And again, the people I sponsor, when they go through, I don't really like that meeting, they're not our kind of people, I don't like the way that woman dresses, I don't like the way that boy dresses. Sorry. It's not up for You know, you don't have to like it. You just have to go. You have to realize that it's not about you. It's taken me so long to realize it's not about me. Part of it's about me, but most of it just isn't. The world spins fine without me. The best thing that happened to me professionally is when I went away to treatment is that hospital did not close down. They didn't even miss me. I didn't even think they knew where I went until they sent me cookies. And then I thought, how do they know I went to a treatment center? Well, everybody knew I went to a treatment center. It wasn't hard. The janitor could have told you I had to go to a treatment center. I really felt like I joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, though, when I did steps 8 and 9. Because 8 and 9 really helped get me connected back to the human race. I hurt a lot of people. I hurt my family, mostly out of neglect. I didn't do anything bad to them. I didn't steal from them or anything, but I just neglected them. Disappeared. Didn't remember my sister's birthdays. Didn't even know if they had kids. Didn't care. And I got to slowly rebuild that with them. I got to do some financial amends. See, when I first moved to Texas, after we finally got into Dallas, you could buy beer at the Shell station. And my dad gave me a Shell card. So I would go to the Shell station and buy lots of beer, or I'd buy you gas and you'd give me cash. And so when he would then say, the gas bill was $600, I would say, Texas is a big state, Dad. We drive a lot in that state. Well, I had to make some of those amends. I had to, and what I did is they wanted this little house somewhere out on a lake. I mean, I think the house was, it was a shack. It was $12,000 or something. I bring it up because what happened to me is the feelings went away, not when I paid that little house off for them, but when I made the first payment, because it was gone. All that stuff was gone. I'm so grateful. I got to do things with my brothers and sisters like be a brother. What an amazing concept that is. I didn't call them anymore at 3 or 4 in the morning sobbing about somebody doing me wrong one more time. It took me, or it took them years after I got sober to tell me the story of what used to happen when I would come home for Christmas. They would have a meeting in the basement. My mother would lead the meeting. It would go something like this. Your brother's coming home for the holidays. Please don't piss him off. If you do, he will ruin our holidays. So now when I have people that I sponsor say, oh, I really don't really want to go home for this holiday, blah, blah, blah. I say, your parents don't want you either. Keep your ass here. They're tired of all that. And my family was tired of it too. And I got to do that by just being a brother again, just staying around and doing the things that families do. We have this family reunion every year for a week in July in Ohio. So go. You know, it's not Paris, but it's doing what you have to do. I had friends again because I started making some in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any actually when I first got here. There were no friends at my intervention, by the way. There was a doctor and one nurse because my friends didn't want the party to end. Actually, my parents probably couldn't have even gone to that intervention because they would have wanted me to come home and they would have fixed me there. But I got friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to make some amends to the old friends I had from college, from high school, who I just, again, ignored because I didn't want to tell them what was going on. I got to make some amends to my coworkers and to my patients and to the other doctors I worked with. Because you know what happens if you're a surgeon, you entrust your patient's life to me. That's what I do. That and I keep the music going. But I mean, that's really what I do. And I stole their drugs. If you were a patient in my hospital at that time, you did not get any drugs. I'm so sorry. I either would keep you asleep with other things, but you did not get any of my liquid drug. No, no. Mm-mm. If it's between me and you, I will win. And I got to become a physician again. And I got to learn to do it the right way. I still work with huge boxes of that stuff every day. And I do it simply because I'm an alcoholic, and that's what I have to do. I have to remember it's theirs and not mine. It's theirs. It's not mine. It does not have my name on the box. It has their name on the box. And after that hospital, after I left there in disgrace, and after they packed up my locker, 10 years later, I was voted Physician of the Year, that I got to go pick up with my boyfriend. It was actually kind of amazing. I don't know how that happens. You really can't get there from here. I got to do a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous I've really enjoyed. It's an honor always to speak at any kind of convention. It's just even an honor to speak at home, and it's just fun to go to meetings. I still do a couple of them a week. And I do that because it makes me feel better. People at work can even tell when I've been to a meeting the night before, because all of a sudden it's not about them. It's not their fault anymore. It's about my fault. And I enjoy going to meetings. I have a wonderful life today. I really do. I have great friends. I have two best friends. One is my friend Harvey, who is my roommate. I've never gotten to make that thing with a boyfriend actually work. Maybe more will be revealed. So I'm living with my best friend. He's 26 years sober, and we have meetings all the time. My other good friend is a guy named Kurt, who's not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, doesn't need to be, on his own spiritual journey. Who knew? I thought you had to be here to be on a spiritual journey, but we have not cornered the market on spirituality, I hate to tell you. There are other people who are out there doing it all by themselves because they want to, not because they have to. My life is really good today. I'm in a strange place. You know, I'm in my mid-40s. I'm sober. I'm single. And a couple years ago, two of the three of those things would have bothered me to hell. But those are just the facts of my life. That's where I am today. And I'm sure that God has much more in store. I know there's a lot more that I still have to do. I'm actually getting ready to go with my brothers and sisters on a trip for a couple weeks they want to go to Italy, so we're going to go to Italy for 2 weeks. I'm not sure how that's going to turn out. I'm going to just try to be a brother and just do my thing and let them do their thing and not have to be in charge of it all and just let them whirl as they do all the time. They whirl all the time because they don't have this program. And I'm not going to force it down their throats. If they want it, they know where to get it. I want everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has to give me. I want the full meal deal. I want the Biggie Coke. I want the toy at the end. And the only way I know to do that is to keep going to meetings. I'd like to end with a story that actually I got from my friend Helen. It's so funny that you're here tonight. It's a story that I think helps me define what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And it's a story about a wise man asking the Lord to show him a vision of heaven and hell. And the Lord takes him to a hallway, and there's two rooms. And he opens the first door, and in this room, there's a big round table. And on the table is a great big pot of stew. And it's warm, and it's aromatic. And yet the people sitting around the table are all emaciated and angry and yelling at each other. Because, see, each of the people have fastened to their arm this oddly shaped spoon that's long enough to reach the stew, but not long enough to turn back around and feed themselves. And the Lord says, well, you've seen hell. So they go back out into the hallway and they go to the next room, and in this room there's a big round table and there's the big pot of stew. But these people are happy and smiling and having a good time. They're well fed. And yet they each have that oddly shaped spoon and it's still attached to their hand. And the wise man says, I don't understand. And God says, you see, in this room, they learn to feed each other. And that's what I have to remember about Alcoholics Anonymous, that this is the room where we feed each other. When I go to a meeting of AA, sometimes I've had a bad day. the chances of all of you also having a same bad day are phenomenally impossible. Y'all can't have had a bad day the same day I had a bad day. And you tell me that. And then other days when I've had a good day, you may have had a bad day. That's part of the magic of this program. That's part of the thing that keeps it going, is the fact that it's one alcoholic sharing with another. Just like I learned from the very beginning, just like they did my intervention, it was one alcoholic saying, there's a better way of doing this, and it's different than the way you're doing it. And I think it'll work a lot better for you if you just try it our way. I've had a wonderful time up here. I'm really looking forward to hearing Starkey and David talk in the next couple days. And I thank you for your time.